Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 6, Dhyana Yoga, text number 7. Chitatmana prasantasya paramatma samahita shitoshna sukadukeshu tatamano pamanayo chitatma. Of one who has conquered his mind. Prashantasya. Who has attained tranquility by such control over the mind. Parama Atma. The Super Soul. Samahita. Approached completely. Shita. In cold. Ushna, heat. Sukha, happiness. Dukeshu, and distress. Tata, also. Mana, and honor. Apamanayo, and dishonor. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. For one who has conquered the mind, the super soul is already reached, for he has attained tranquility. And to such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold, honor and dishonor, all the same. Purport. Actually, every living entity is intended to abide by the dictation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is seated in everyone's heart as Paramatma. When the mind is misled by the external illusory energy, one becomes entangled in material activities. Therefore, as soon as one's mind is controlled through one of the yoga systems, one should be considered to have already reached the destination. One has to abide by superior dictation. When one's mind is fixed on the superior nature, he has no alternative but to follow the dictation of the Supreme. The mind must emit some superior dictation and follow it. The effect of controlling the mind is that one automatically follows the dictation of the Paramatma, or Super Soul, because this transcendental position is at once achieved by one who is in Krishna consciousness. The devotee of the Lord is unaffected by the dualities of material existence, namely distress and happiness, cold and heat, etc. This state is practical samadhi, or absorption, in the Supreme. Chitatmana prasantasya paramatma samahita shitoshna sukadukeshu tatamana pamanayo. For one who has conquered the mind, the super soul is already reached, for he has attained tranquility. To such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold, honor and dishonor are all the same. Arjuna is on a battlefield. Naturally, he's supposed to conquer the enemy. But as Prahlad Maharaj said, in this world there's actually no enemy except for the uncontrolled mind. Now the question is, what does uncontrolled mean? Because people are working seriously to get material advancement. They certainly seem to have a controlled mind. There are people who are trained specifically to control their mind in so many different, and control other people's minds, mind control. Because what is the definition of control of the mind? That's Bhagavad Gita has its own definition, that the mind is controlled when it's fixed on the Supreme. Otherwise, as we said before, that nashti buddhiya yuktasya, nachi yuktasya bhavanaha, nachabhavyantakshantir, ashantasya kutaksukam. That for one who is not in the divine or Krishna consciousness can have neither a steady mind or controlled mind nor steady intelligence, without which there is no possibility of peace, and how can there be any happiness without peace? So this connects with the idea of becoming peaceful first. And no one can be peaceful unless they realize that they're eternal. Because our main anxieties, we believe we're going to die. Now, we may forget about it when we're younger, to a certain extent, but still everyone looks both ways before they cross the street. And now people are thinking, well, the coronavirus is here. There is some possibility I might die. As if there was no possibility before the coronavirus came that we might die. So everyone's afraid of death because we're in ignorance. And you just don't walk out of ignorance. You don't decide one day you wake up, I don't want to be in ignorance anymore. I'll just realize I'm eternal today. It doesn't work like that. What's that? Today, or maybe tomorrow if it takes a while. Now, Krishna has explained that we are eternal, which is good that we're eternal, but to be eternally in hell is not a very good position. So we have to get out of our condition of being always in anxiety and 8,400,000 species of life about having to leave this body, whatever body we have. And the way Krishna is saying conquer the mind, and the way of doing it is to abide by the orders of the super soul in the heart. Or it says, here it's the opposite. If one can control the mind, then we'll naturally follow the dictation of the orders of the super soul within the heart. So how do we control the mind? Well, we engage in devotional service externally, and then when the mind is engaged in Krishna's service, then naturally the super soul says, Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam. Then I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. In other words, the super soul is our friend, but he can only give us as much information as we desire and as much as we deserve. So we're engaged in activities that show we have no interest in realizing that we're eternal, we're absorbed in the temporary. Then Krishna can't help us in that way. He'll help us achieve whatever we want to achieve in the material sphere. He'll give us that intelligence. But when he sees that we're actually trying to realize our eternal nature and our relation with the Supreme, then the first thing he does, he brings us into contact with his representatives, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And he allows us to take advantage of them, and he inspires us when we do by giving us realized knowledge. Tesham eva nukamparatam aham agyana jam tamaha nashamyam yapabhavishto jnana dipena bhashvata. So Krishna enlightens us within the heart. He reveals himself. Or the process is summarized. What are we trying to learn when we come in contact with Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra? The first thing we're trying to learn is everything belongs to Krishna. So that's a lot of things. Means that nirmana moha jita sangha dosha, nothing is actually mine. Now, we have that feeling that something must be mine. It's just too inconceivable that everything belongs to Krishna. It appears that something is mine, and I need these things. I mean, Krishna has enough. He has all these planets and everything. What does he need? What I have? I mean, he's not greedy, is he? He's not envious of the little things that I have. That everything belongs to Krishna. Now, Krishna is not telling us because he's lacking something and he needs what we have. But he's telling us because that mood that things belong to me keeps us in ignorance, because nothing really does belong to us. In other words, there's a connection we have with the super soul who's sensing our desires, which whether we like it or not are like prayers. People don't know that they're praying to the super soul by their desires. And it's not exactly their desires. We take it even, it's not even our desires. We've somehow or another come in contact with the illusory energy, material energy, since time immemorial, and we've acted in various ways to create a subtle body which under different circumstances arising according to time and the three modes of material nature, activities called karma coming into being. In other words, desires arisen within our minds, arise within our mind. And we have a choice which desire we're going to fulfill. Now, if there's no spiritual desire, or there's no idea that everything belongs to Krishna, and that I'm thinking that the purpose of my life is to get something in this material world, accumulate something in this material world, or protect the things that I already have. So those are our choices. Either we try to protect, there's desires to protect what we have, or there's desires to get what we don't have, or there's a possibility of desiring to find out what Krishna wants us to do with his property. So that's the other thing. In other words, if we actually, as much as we accept that everything belongs to Krishna, will be shown by how much interest we have in trying to figure out what Krishna wants us to do. Now, we can give perfect classes about how everything belongs to Krishna and then go out trying to get more from me and make sure I don't lose anything, rather than actually contemplating, what can I do for Krishna? What does Krishna want me to do? Now, the first thing that comes into my mind is not necessarily what Krishna wants me to do. What does Krishna want me to do? Oh, ice cream. Yeah, all right, maybe he wants me to get some ice cream. Ask Lali Govind to make me some ice cream. Krishna wants me to get some ice cream. No, there's guru, there's sadhu and shastra. Of course we say, well, my guru is so far away that how can I possibly know what my guru wants me to do? Well, actually, guru is supposed to speak according to Bhagavad Gita, and we have Bhagavad Gita, and it's not like a mystery. That Krishna makes everything very complicated, and, you know, to bet on this horse or this horse, I don't know, maybe, what does my guru want me to do? Now, if we're in the realm of spiritual life, the nine processes, specifically of bhakti, then we can inquire how we should engage our body, mind, and words in the process of bhakti. And if we go outside the platform of bhakti, and then we try to figure out what my guru wants me to do, then that's, my guru is supposed to tell me how to engage in bhakti, in the process of bhakti. He's not supposed to tell us what horse to bet on, or how many angels can fit on the point of a pin. That's not what he's supposed to be telling us. He's supposed to tell us how to appropriately engage in devotional service under different circumstances, giving the examples of previous acharyas, previous examples in our scriptures, etc. That's the duty, is to try to ascertain what would be pleasing to Krishna under different circumstances. So if we accept that and humbly pray, humbly investigate through Guru and Sadhu and Shastra, consciously, in other words, we become conscious of investigating and inquiring, then when one is always submissive and is ready to render service, then the reciprocation of knowledge and inquiries becomes perfect. That if we want knowledge, spiritual knowledge, if we're inquisitive about that, then we have to become submissive and be ready to render service. Submissive, that is, submissive inquiry, to actually ascertain what Krishna wants us to do. And when that's clear, and we do it, then the reciprocation of knowledge and inquiries becomes perfect. Then we'll actually realize what Krishna says. Everything here belongs to him. Surprise. Then we'll actually realize that Krishna actually is, when Krishna is happy, when Krishna enjoys, of course he's always enjoying, but when we connect with his enjoyment, when we actually participate in his enjoyment, then we actually enjoy. And that we can't take credit for anything. What we're getting is pure mercy, the opportunity to connect with Krishna again, become useful again. So, it's not that the spiritual world is just waiting for us to come back. It's on hold right now. Everything is going on. The only thing that's not going on are all these useless souls in the material world just chasing after illusion. But we can connect again and become useful. So that's by the mercy of Krishna and his representatives. It's simply out of love, because there's no material reason. The spiritual world, the spiritual consciousness exists out of love. There's no need for anyone in the spiritual world. No one needs us. That we're like a vital mechanic, we're some mechanic that kept Krishna's, you know, Vaikuntha airplanes moving. And they're running short of mechanics and they need us to get back there as soon as possible. Fix a few Vaikuntha airplanes. It's not like that. It's simply everyone has an opportunity. The more people participate in Krishna's loving service, then the more everyone becomes blissful. That's all. We're just like an anomaly here. In any case, if we accept that everything belongs to Krishna, everything we find out should be used for Krishna's service, then we also have to develop some positive attitude that we actually want to please Krishna. We want to develop love. Not that, all right, unfortunately everything belongs to Krishna, I got a hand in the stolen goods back, tell me how to do it. I don't want to get punished anymore. So that's the impersonalist. They want to get out of the material world, they give it all back. Yes, I don't need it, just tell me how to get out of this place. I'm done with it. But they're not interested in going back to Krishna or establishing a loving relationship to him. They don't understand that actually our real need is a loving relationship with Krishna that everyone has. And when they develop that loving relationship with Krishna, then actually they develop a loving relationship with everyone else who's in relationship to Krishna. But the central point is Krishna, Ishvara, Prema. Without that, that our lives are incomplete and unsatisfied. And because they're incomplete or unsatisfied, the mind will never be satisfied. It'll always be looking for something to satisfy. The soul will always be utilizing the mind and the intelligence to find something to satisfy it. But only when it reestablishes its relationship with Krishna can it actually find real satisfaction in the loving relationship that it has with Krishna. Otherwise, they're just talking about romance and love all the time. Because now they're just talking about the relationship with the coronavirus. Maybe that's the new love affair. Or hate affair, whatever it is. But anyhow, the whole world is just filled with talks about romance and love and friendship and society and all the different rasas that are going in the material world. The ghastly rasa, the seven indirect rasas, and then we have the five direct ones, our servants, our friends, our parents, our lovers, those who are neutral to us. So the whole material world is an attempt in enjoying relationships unsuccessfully because they're actually looking for Krishna. And they know in some relationship there must be that loving experience that I'm looking for, that actual person who actually loves me and wants to help me and protect me. So that's Krishna, that everyone is actually searching for Krishna. But they're just looking in the wrong place, that's all. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Hare Krishna. In this verse, Krishna says that one, and Srila Prabhupada also says, that one who is in Krishna consciousness is unaffected by the dualities, like cold and heat. But we don't expect from any devotee to be totally impervious to cold and heat. So how do we understand that he is unaffected by cold and heat?
Well, advanced devotees are actually unaffected by cold and heat. Just like Prahlad Maharaj was unaffected by such circumstances. Or we have Abhiram, what was Abhiram Das Thakura's first disciple and only disciple that he found, Abhiram Das, who would go into the far, he would go underwater for 3 days chanting japa. So obviously he was unaffected by his material circumstances. We don't expect immediately, but the more we concentrate on Krishna, then the more we become aloof from these things. Now, exalted devotees like Prabhupada may have exhibited seemingly that he was affected by these things, because otherwise there would be no service for the devotees to render. If someone is completely transcendental, then, and unaware of their body, because it's not, even if we're transcendental, it may not always be that the body will, anyhow, Krishna, for an advanced devotee, Krishna has his ways of doing things so that Krishna inspires service from others. And he also shows that the body is not going to be eternal. So there's some, and at the same time, his devotee is actually aloof from the whole thing. So it becomes what Krishna is trying to show under those circumstances. It takes quite a bit of intelligence. And therefore that verse that no one can really understand the activities of a pure devotee. But a pure devotee, Prabhupada, the example is given. When Prabhupada, when they were building the temple in Vrindavan, 1974, I guess it started probably around 73 or something, and they're having difficulty building the temple due to different reasons. Probably main one is that I guess the devotees were spaced out. Foreigners living in India, and at that time living in India was really austere. I doubt whether they spoke the language. There was hardly any road structure. The communication was quite poor. They were foreigners. The people living in Vrindavan were not necessarily very favorable. They didn't get really much assistance from anyone. They thought there was the CIA or other things. Or there was some movie that came out, Dumb Buddy Dumb. What was that? Take Another Puff. There's a movie, the first movie that came out about the devotees in India. It's called Dum Bari Dum, Take Another Puff. It showed the devotees, the reason why they looked so happy is that they were smoking marijuana all the time. That's how they portrayed in the first Indian movie about the devotees. Bum Dari, and they just go out and, you know, chant, hey, let's go take a break. My throat's a little dry. In any case, they were having a hard time building the temple, but they were giving Prabhupada all these positive reports, you know. The temple's almost ready. And so Prabhupada took it at face value and he invited the chief minister and all the members of parliament and all the devotees from all over the world. I bought my plane ticket as the temple president at that time to fly to India for the opening in 1974. Mayapur. And then Prabhupada arrived February, I think, something like that, to check and make sure everything was all right for the opening. And when he got there, it was a construction site. Nothing was built. I don't even think there were walls on the temple. I was there, actually, previously to that. And they're actually, I guess they didn't make very much progress because there were no walls in the temple. It was just part of Prabhupada's quarters were constructed. And so Prabhupada was furious because he invited, you know, probably a couple hundred devotees from around the world that bought their tickets, and all these dignitaries from India were coming, and there was nothing. So he became so fiery that demanding, what is this? What have you done? And he was so fiery that everyone thought devotees there thought he had become like Nrisimhadeva. And they were hiding in different places. So finally, after a couple of hours or whatever it was, Prabhupada went back to his quarters and everyone was afraid to go there. But one devotee had to go there, so he saw Prabhupada was completely calm. And he was inquiring from Prabhupada, you know, just before you were completely fiery, and now you're completely calm. He said, yes, a pure devotee, externally he may work in one way, just like on the surface of an ocean. There are so many waves and there's the storms coming up, etc. But deep inside the ocean, everything is very calm. So a pure devotee is like that. Externally, he may act in certain ways in order to act as Krishna's instrument. But internally, he's living in the spiritual world, and therefore he's always very calm and undisturbed by any material circumstance. So that's how we should understand it. But as far as, you know, Prabhupada's feeling cold in New York or something, that's something that goes, what is that verse, Muje? Vaishnava Kriya Muda. Mud, yeah. So, it's now we have to take it like that. Anything else? Yes.
So what did Prabhupada do after
this Mayapur situation?
No, Vrindavan. What did he do afterwards?
Yeah, like...
Well, he told him to get it together. He contacted... I got a letter saying, don't come to India. we're not going to have an opening. And he contacted someone contacted all those dignitaries, told him not to come. What else could he do? And then he gave them instructions how to try to finish this at some time. I guess it was opened in 75 probably in the Kartik. What's that?
Ramnomi.
So it was open. He had to delay everything. What else could he do? Invite the Prime Minister and the Chief Minister. Here's our construction site. It's all spiritual. It's all one. You just have to use your imagination. The deities are there, but only time separates us. Anything else? Thank you very much. Krantaraj Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai.